My name is Reed Lessing, and welcome to Lectionary at Lunch. Our text for our delightful meditation is Isaiah, Yeshayahu, 51, 1 through verse 6. And this is a great section, as I like to say. It's in the middle of the best 16 chapters of the Bible. And that would be Isaiah 40 to 55. In this section of the book of Isaiah, the prophet is speaking to exiles in Babylon. And for our purposes, it's very important to understand that the people have lost their righteous standing. That is to say, if we begin in chapter 48, this idea of Zedekiah, which is so pivotal to 51, 1 to 6, we can see at the end of 48, verse 1, that the people invoke the God of Israel, but not in Emmet and not in Zedekiah, not in truthfulness, not in righteousness. So without rehearsing all of the debate and the issues, suffice it to say that the most current commentators on this section of Isaiah will say that at this point in chapter 48, because of idolatry, which Isaiah is at pains to discuss throughout chapters 40 to 48, the people have lost their righteous standing. So as we move into chapter 51, the prophet is going to invite the exiles, as well as us, to reaffirm our righteous standing by grace through faith in the accomplished work of the substitute servant, which we will discuss toward the end of our time in chapters 53, and then the results of this in chapter 54, 17c. So I would suggest that the sermon revolve around this idea of righteousness, and we would also want to note that for St. Paul, his understanding of righteousness, specifically in the epistle to the Romans, that in the gospel, a righteousness is revealed, right? Romans 1:17. That this righteousness that's been revealed, Paul gets from specifically Isaiah chapters 51 to 55. Ross Wagner, a Pauline scholar who teaches at Princeton Theological Seminary, maintains that chapters 51 to 55, quote, exercise a profound influence on the very foundation of Paul's theology as expressed in Romans. So we certainly have a lot to consider, and that would get us started. So we go to chapter 51, verse 1. Hear me, so Yahweh speaking, Shemu Eli, the ones pursuing Zedek. So, contrary to the way Lutherans normally present righteousness, Isaiah is going to speak to those who are pursuing an act of righteousness, rodafeh zedek. But in a sense, theologically, but certainly not textually, but theologically, he's putting the cart before the horse. Because the only way people can pursue an act of righteousness and seek Yahweh is to have a passive righteousness that is gifted to them by Yahweh, which Isaiah will in the next line begin to discuss. So this Hifil imperative from Nabat, along with Zedek and Zedekiah, is really a theme word in our text. So it comes in the second line of 51:1, Habitu, again 51:2. And then as we go toward the end of our pericope, we are looking at chapter 51, verse 6. Lift up toward the heavens your eyes, ve'habitu el ha'aretz te'katak. So again, three times, this idea of look closely, look intently. The Hebrew and Aramaic lexicon of the Old Testament offers the understanding that we would, let me find this on my notes. Look with confidence towards. So it's more than ra'ah, which is the normal Hebrew word to see. So look confidently, look intently, stare, gaze, look closely. This is very important that we understand this. So look closely to the rock. And this next word, we're back in 51 verse 1. Ku-tsav-tem. It looks like a pu'al with that kibbutz under the chet and the dagesh 14, the tzade. But it's a unanimous understanding by the grammarians. This is actually an old call passive. How do they know that? Because the verb itself, beth, resh, chet. I'm sorry, I'm looking at the wrong line here. Chet, tzade, beth, right? Katsav does not appear in the PL. See, so if it doesn't appear in the PL, how can it appear in the pu'al? So grammarians say this is a call passive. Either way, look to the rock from which we would supply the relative pronoun here, because in poetry, asher is rather sparse. So look to the rock from which you have been hewn. So rock is a good metaphor here for Abraham and for Sarah too, because they're really, in large sense, dead. Sarah is a postmenopausal barren woman, and there's really no hope, you see, for life coming out of a rock. But miracle of miracles, Yahweh does it. So look to the rock from which you have been hewn, and to the cavity of the bore would be pit or hole from which you were cut. So the metaphor here is that these exiles in Babylon are little rocks from the big rock, and in this case it would be Abraham. Verse 2, again, look intently, gaze, look confidently toward Avraham, Avikim, your father, and to Sarah, the one who bore you. This next verb would be a polel from het, lam, and lamet. Ki akad, because from one, he called, or I called him, karativ. And I blessed him, and I multiplied him. Now, these next couple of verbs here are actually call imperfect vav conjunctives. So that's why most of the versions, including Qumran A, the great Isaiah scroll, translate these as vav consecutive imperfects. It's a past idea, but in the Masoretic text, the BHS, they're pointed as future ideas. But we would translate, because one, I called him, and I blessed him, and I multiplied him. Well, the big idea here, if we're preaching on righteousness, which again, I would just say as a pastor, we think parishioners get this. This idea of a passive and an act of righteousness, but so often they just simply don't. And this is a great opportunity to tell the story of Abraham, who in Genesis chapter 15 verse 6 is the first person, see, to actually receive the passive gift of righteousness. Genesis 15:5, which precedes this, we have the theme word nabat again, where Avram is to look closely at the stars, and then he receives this passive righteousness by faith. If you're kind of tracking with Abraham, then in Genesis 18:19, We have the active righteousness, where the command is to do tzedakah u'mishpat, justice and righteousness, in Genesis 18:19. So as people look at the past, they look to the miracle of Abraham and Sarah and the gift of passive righteousness. Now in verse 3, they are to look toward the future. Indeed, ki nekam Yahweh Tzion. I would take this PL perfect from nekam as an instantaneous perfect. Not that Yahweh has comforted, but he's in the process of doing it now. Really, a major idea in this section of Isaiah 40 to 55 is chapter 43, verse 19, where Yahweh's doing a new thing. So as a performative speech act, that in the statement, Yahweh, ki nekam Yahweh Tzion, he's actually comforting them. Comfort, of course, nakamu nakamu ami, comfort, comfort my people, begins this unit in Isaiah in chapter 40, verse 1. So comfort is more than a pat on the back or go win one for the gipper. In this case, the second line, nekam kol korboteha, he is comforting all her ruins, her desolate places. Comfort means restoration. It means rebuilding. It means a new life. So then we have a kind of surprisingly a call imperfect vav consecutive, and he will put place set her midbar, her wilderness, like Eden. Again, not surprising, many of the versions emend the text, and he will place her wilderness like Eden. And going with that, that is our clue then that the nekams in the first part of the line would be instantaneous perfects because we have a vav conjunctive call imperfect from seem. So that disambiguates these perfect verbs. Okay, so now look at the future. It'll be like Eden and her inhabitable places, her wasteland, the Arabah, will be like the Garden of Yahweh. Sison Vesimka, joy and rejoicing will be found in her, Nifal, from Matzah there, Dagesh 14, the Mame, and the theme vowel, the comments under the Mame, for a Nifal imperfect. And thanksgiving and a voice of Zimrah, a voice of music. So we might say, well, when the exiles returned, it wasn't like Eden, right? And so what we would want to note here is that as Israel's history moved from tribulation in Babylon back to Judah, there was no Eden-like life in Persian Yehud. Did Yahweh's word fail? Did his mercy cease? Did his love come to an end for all time? No. Israel's return from Babylon was a partial fulfillment of the new creation that we see here, a kind of first fruits. There was more to come in Jesus Christ. We too live in the same tension. We have the first fruits. As Paul reminds us in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. But yet we still, groan inwardly, Romans 8:23, as we await the final eschatological victory. For on that day, Christ will transform our lowly body to be like his glorious body, Philippians 3:21. So on that day, on the last day, the wilderness will be like the Garden of Eden in the New Jerusalem. So we live in the now and the not yet, just as Israel did. Verse 4, Hifil imperative from Keshav, which means to hearken. Hearken to me, my people, and my people to me. Another Hifil imperative from Azan, listen. For Torah from me will go forth, and my justice for a light of people. And then we have this kind of strange last word, argi'ah, which is obviously hifil with the hirik yod infix. This word argi'ah means something like a cause to rest. It invites people to understand that they are invited to Yahweh's holy rest, but it's a little bit strange here. But I think we get the general idea. If we have the new promised land restored in verse 3, then there's rest in that land at the end of verse 4. So here we come across the second use of the root zedek. Here it's not in a in an active way like verse 1, but in a passive way in this particular verse. So as we begin verse 4, I want to highlight that verses 4, 5, and 6 in Isaiah 51 have 9 nouns and 4 prepositions, and all of them appear with the first-person suffix. My people, my nation, my justice, my deliverance, 2 times. We're going to translate Zidki here, deliverance or righteousness. That's 2 times. My salvation, 2 times. My arm, 2 times. So this whole program is Yahweh's program, this program of righteousness. My righteousness or my deliverance is near. When Zidki is parallel here with Yeshi, salvation, most translations steer away from the word righteousness and they use the word victory or something along those lines. Victory, deliverance, and my salvation, yatsah, here, we would again probably take this as an instantaneous perfect, is coming forth. And here we have a plural, my arms, peoples, they will, yishpotu, call him perfect, third masculine plural from Shaphat. Shaphat in this context means save or deliver. Judge just doesn't bring forth its context with Yeshan and Zedek. So my arms. Well, why is it plural arms? Well, here perhaps Yahweh's arms are pictured using a bow and arrow. That's where most commentators take the plurality of arms here. So Yahweh is this man of war, Exodus 15:3. He is fighting for his people. This is his program. So then to me, it's not only for, you see, the Ami of verse 4, hearken to me, Ami, my people, but it's also for the Iyim, for the coastlands, which would be a synecdoche, a part for the whole. The whole here would be all the nations. So for me, all the nations, peel from Kava will wait. And to my arm, now it's singular, they will put hope in. So Yahweh's arm is a pivotal idea in Isaiah 40-55. Here, of course, it's a strong arm or arms plural, as we've seen earlier in verse 5. It's the arm that we see in 52:10, where Yahweh lays bare his holy arm in the sight of all the people. But this mighty power of Yahweh is made most perfect in weakness. In 53:1, the arm of Yahweh is revealed place and in a person where we would least expect it, right? He grew up before him, 53:2, like a little suckling plant and like a root from the ground of dryness. He didn't have any form or beauty that we should desire him, etc. So here would be the weakness of the arm. So we need both. We need the powerful arm. We need the tender, compassionate arm. Our God is merciful and mighty. He's tender and tough. He's sovereign and saving. And this use of arm here and then in 53:1 really helps us get this dual idea out, perhaps understood in our Savior's exaltation as well as humiliation. Verse 6. Lift up, this is from Nassau, call imperative, second plural, lift up to the heavens your eyes. So now the logic is that there's going to be something more enduring than creation. And what is more enduring? It's my righteous, alien, forensic justification before God. That's what's enduring. And that then propels me toward an act of righteousness, 51 verse 1. So lift up your eyes to the heavens, and here's, you know, look closely, vehabitu, intently, expectantly to the aretz underneath, metakat, for indeed, a severative key, the shemayim, like smoke. And here, malak, this is a hapax legomenon. Most people translate this something like will wear out, nifal, perfect, third common plural. Again, probably understood as a future idea. Logic forces it that way. So the heavens will not be destroyed. No way, Isaiah says. You see in Isaiah 40:22, 44:24, 45:12, 48:13, the heavens are pitched like a tent. So they wear out. Yahweh's going to renew the creation, but he's not going to destroy it and start again. So the heavens will vanish like smoke. The earth will wear out like a garment. Its inhabitants will die like gnats, is the idea. But it's not destruction and start from scratch. So the heavens, this tent, will go up kind of in smoke. Then we have the next line where the prophet continues, and the earth, like a garment, ka veged, will wear away, or wear out, perhaps is better. And then its inhabitants, yosha veha, call active participle, the thematic vowel, the holom over the yod, is our diagnostic marker there. Its inhabitants will, like thus, mu tune. So most of the translations go with chemo and amend the text to understand something like gnats or flies. That's NIV, ESV, NASB, etc. So that probably makes the most sense. So the heavens will vanish like smoke. The earth will wear out like a garment, and its inhabitants will die like flies. See, but my salvation, le'olam tihyeh, my salvation will be forever. And here's the idea, and my righteousness or my victory, my gift of a righteous standing will never be ended. This whole idea of olam is a programmatic, thematic idea in Isaiah 40:55. Why does Yahweh's salvation and righteousness stand forever? Because Yahweh himself is Elohe Olam. He is the everlasting God. And we have that in chapter 40, verse 28. His word endures forever. Chapter 40, verse 8. His chesed, his covenant love, endures forever. And we have that in 54, verse 8. His covenant is forever. That's in 55, verse 3. So we can count on this salvation being forever because it's backed up by an eternal God with an eternal word, with an eternal love, and an eternal covenant. So blessings to you as you study this marvelous text and preach upon it to the joy and edifying of Christ's most holy people. Thanks for joining us.